nice weather there in Texas, it sounds like, for him. And I pray that he's got everything ordered and ready to give the sermon here today. So, Mr. Fleming, I'm going to hand you back the microphone, and we'll hear the sermon from you today, Mr. Fleming.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Russell. And greetings to everyone again. That's always a nice Sabbath. I don't care what the weather's like. It's just the day I look forward to every week. So I hope you do the same. Well, brethren, a few weeks ago, this month, first part of the month, we witnessed celebrating the 4th of July. And it's, it usually stirs up our patriotism. You know, we probably all hear various comments about that historical period and our founders' conceptions of human nature, but you know, we're not going to talk about patriotism today, but equality and worth, our human worth. And as you probably know, I have a strong interest in history as well as religion. The subject today, it's probably going to be a little bit new to some of you. I doubt some of it you probably ever heard before. And I hope you find it interesting and edifying, as I mentioned in the prayer, because we want to look into our worth as humans. Now, there's a well-known sentence that was penned by Thomas Jefferson. He writes in the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." That is a lofty statement indeed. Now, Jefferson's assertion that men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights suggests that mankind has value, and that value, like the rights which supposedly spring from those values, is unalienable. Now, that's not a word we use too much anymore. It's even hard to say. Unalienable simply means not capable of being separated, meaning the citizens of this great country cannot be separated from these God-given rights. Now, one dictionary defines unalienable as protected from being removed or taken away. Synonyms, you know, similar words, include unassailable, inviolable, natural, inherent, basic, and absolute. The words generally use, however, in a more philosophic context, and can get a little bit abstract, but we can kind of bring it down to earth if we want by comparing it or combining it with some of the Holy Scriptures. So let's start today in the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 22, Proverbs 22 and verse 15. It says, "Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him." And you probably think, well, what does that have to do with our worth? Well, using this scripture, we can properly say that children have an unalienable ability or a proclivity to behave foolishly. Now, they don't have to behave that way when they reach adulthood, hopefully. Some do, some never grow up. Yet as children, we can say that such behavior is innate. It's inherent. It's built into them. In other words, it's natural to them. And that should give us a pretty good idea of what the word unalienable means. But was Jefferson right when he said that mankind possesses built-in value, natural value, value that cannot be removed or relinquished? And if so, you know, how did mankind get it? Who gave it to them? Now, today I want to discuss or address the question of the value of mankind. What is it? You know, where does it come from? And what are its implications? Are some people more equal than others? So let's define the base word here, value. It has a number of meanings. And I want to read from a very old edition of Webster's Dictionary. Actually, it's pre-turn of the century. But it is by far the most complete definition that I found on value. And like they say, it's an oldie, but it's a goodie. It defines value as worth, property, or those properties of a thing that render it useful or esteemable. the real value of a thing is its true utility, its power or capacity of procuring or producing good. And as the old Webster's edition so often did, center our lives a little bit more around God, and they actually incorporated scriptures from the old, the King James Version of the Bible, and in their some of their definitions. And in the worst, the use of the word value, they bring this one up. They give us Job 13, verse 4. You don't need to really turn there. It says, you are all physicians of no value. Matthew 10, verse 31. It says, do not fear, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. And a lot of the modern versions often render that as your worth is more than many sparrows. So it's our value or our worth. So think of value as worth or usefulness. Now, however, you know, value, worth, usefulness, as Webster's points out, is a little bit subjective. It's generally based on somebody's opinion or fashion. Now, we often say we evaluate something. Notice that the word value is right there in the middle of that word. We evaluate something, and we assign to it a value. And not everybody is going to agree with our evaluation. You know, an example might be an antique store, which for some people is just a junk store. To some, it's a treasure trove. Just depends on your perspective and how you evaluate it. Personally, I like antiques. But with that as a background, I think we're kind of ready to ask the questions, who put the price on our head, our value? Who assigned value or worth to us as a people? Who determined that we're useful? And given, you know, that there are like 7+ billion people out there on this planet, can an individual be of any value or any use as an individual? That's a lot of people. And as we try to answer these questions, I want to, you know, consider Jefferson's thoughts on the topic. He wrote that people are endowed by their creator. And this is where things might get a little controversial with you. I want to make clear, Jefferson was not an individual who bore respect for the God of Abraham. He was a deist, as were many of the founding fathers, somebody that advocated natural religion based on human morality instead of divine revelation. And actually, Jefferson was quite steeped in pagan mythology. And if you've ever visited his home there, you'll know that the front door of that home is carved with all kinds of images of pagan gods and goddesses. Now, in 1804, this is, I hope I don't bore you with the history here, but I find it very interesting, and I hope you do too. It does tie into what we're looking at today. Now, in 1804, Jefferson produced a version of the New Testament, and he called it, what else, the Jefferson Bible. Basically, it was a version of the Gospels which expunged, or it took out, all allusions to the supernatural. So what you have is a New Testament without any reference to Christ, resurrection, or anything like that, that he was the Son of God. Jefferson, like many of the leaders back then, were products of enlightened thinking. And this enlightenment was a philosophical movement which began in Europe 1650 or so. And it also became a very important political movement as time went by. And many of these European countries formed their thoughts and these philosophies formed a black backdrop for the new American government as it was set up. So basically, though, it touted the importance of reason over religion. Now, there was another famous history person back there in our history, and that's Thomas Paine, probably somebody that you'll recognize. At the time there, he was in prison, and he actually wrote a pamphlet called The Age of Reason. And in that pamphlet, he questioned the legitimacy of the Bible, and he argued for deism. He was in favor of it. because he was also a deist. So let me explain a little bit more about deism. Deism is the idea of a watchmaker or a clockmaker, and that clockmaker was God. That God simply built the universe. It was a nice working universe, and he saw that it was working just fine, and so he just walked away and left it to run. That's kind of the basics of what the, they found things on. They certainly did not have any vision of God as a sovereign in history and in the affairs of men. In fact, they didn't see God in the lives of individuals in any way. They certainly didn't see him fulfilling promises and working to bring about some plan as we do. In other words, they rejected our God, the God of Abraham, the God of promises. Now, Enlightenment thinkers shunned the belief in a single authority. And you can see that also in the way our government was set up. They shunned a single authority, whether it was God or the Pope or a king. So who or what was Jefferson's creator, as he mentions there in that second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence? Well, we can find a clue in the first paragraph of that document, where he makes a reference to the laws of nature, of nature's God. In Jefferson's formula, God becomes connected with nature. And since these enlightened philosophers left the knowledge of the true sovereign God, the God of Abraham, out of their knowledge, they were only left with a God of nature. And this was the God that people like Jefferson and Franklin and Paine recognized. And you know, when it came down to brass tacks, you know, God, as we know him, was really just a vague God of nature. And by nature, they meant more than just you know, trees or something. They meant human nature, the nature of man. And they would actually use the phrase, you know, human nature at times in some of their philosophies. And, you know, when we think about it, hopefully that comes to mind, we know that the God they are really talking about is the God of this world. And we know who that is. Now, what most of these leaders, and please understand, I'm not talking about the common people back then. They still had very deep roots in Puritan thinking. Most of them were quite Bible-believing. But many of the founding fathers were enlightened deists, and they believed in a version of an ancient God of nature. And that idea eventually trickled down to the common citizen in later years, so that now in our modern times we have the common people of this country mostly reject the Bible and any form of religion. Our churches are becoming, you know, even you name it, Catholic, Protestant, or whatever, they're going out of business. I mean, they're closing down and selling huge glass cathedrals that used to have tens of thousands of evangelistic members. I mean, you know, it just doesn't get anywhere with the average person, particularly what we would call the millennials or the younger people right now. You know, our modern population has gone through public education, and they've been thoroughly brainwashed to be an atheist or an agnostic at best. The leaders then, today, like the ones then, you know, like the ones today, for the most part, and especially in our institutions of higher learning, they're enlightened intellectuals that have no use for religion or the God of the Bible. Now, what is the problem with all this? Well, this is where we need to think a little bit deeper. The problem with enlightenment thinking about nature and the nature and the giver and the grantor of human value and human rights is this. Nature is a personification. It's something that represents a person, but it is not a person. Nature is not a rational being. So how can nature impart value to mankind or to people? How can it determine usefulness? How can nature which lacks any cognitive abilities, give mankind any value or any rights. Now, a thinking being has to make an evaluation. You know, that word again, value, of what determines value or worth. How can nature, you know, whether we spell it with a capital N or a small n, do that when nature does not think? Now, it takes a thinking being, and we know who that is, to impart value, to impart worth. In the case of man, it is God, not nature, who imparts value. Notice Genesis 1 and verse 26. Let's go to Genesis 1 and verse 26. This is an astounding statement when you look at it. It says, "Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." Because God is a thinking family. And he declared man to be of value because he wants us to be like them, like God. God is valuable. In fact, it's the most valuable family in existence. Now, enough of the history and the philosophy lesson. Let's take a little bit of a walk through more scriptures now to see how valuable God is. And we're going to begin Deuteronomy 10. I'm just going to read some of these. You can turn to them if you want. Probably go through several of them pretty fast, though. Speaking in Deuteronomy 10, verse 14, these scriptures indicate the value or worth of our God. And you can write them down. It's Deuteronomy 10, verse 14. It says, "Indeed, heaven and the highest heavens belong to the Lord your God, and also the earth with all that is in it." God's ownership is so inclusive that it can only be described in words like all and everything. And we'll see that over and over again. Psalms 24 in verse 1. Psalms 24 verse 1 says, "The earth and everything in it is the Lord's, and all its fullness, the world and those who dwell therein." Psalms 50 verse 12. It says, "If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world and everything in it is mine." This is God speaking. "And all its fullness." The implication being that if God were hungry, he wouldn't have any problem finding something to eat. He owns everything. Psalm 89, verse 11. Again, speaking of God, "The heavens are yours. The earth also is yours. The world and everything in it, all its fullness, you have founded them or created them." God owns everything because he did create everything. Now, let's do turn to one here. It's First Chronicles. First Chronicles, this one we don't turn to hardly ever. Chapter 29, and we're going to read verse 11 and 12. First Chronicles 29, verse 11 and 12, because David makes it clear that God's greatness is exhibited not only in his greatness, but in his outworking of history, even working out the fortunes of individuals in many cases. He says here, "Yours, O Lord, is the greatness, the power and the glory, the victory and the majesty, for all that is in heaven and in earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Lord, and you are exalted as head over all." You know, notice that God isn't just the creator of nature, but of a kingdom, of a government, of all. "Both riches and honor come from you, and you reign over all. In your hand is power and might. In your hand it is to make great and to give strength to all." So God is not only the most expansive being in the universe, God is also the most valuable being as well. His net worth, as Chronicles 29, God interfaces with, he interacts with mankind, enriching and ennobling mankind on a personal level. And when God said he was going to create man like him, he's saying that he would add value to mankind, make him, mankind, valuable. And importantly here, God didn't just say that he was going to add value to man. He didn't just say it. He did it. Let's turn back to Genesis 1 again. Genesis 1 and verse 27. And I'm going to read this out of the New International Version. It says, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. So God did it. Well, this all leads into a question that's asked a number of times in the scriptures, and I think we need to ask and review those times as we take another little walk through the scriptures on God's Sabbath. What is mankind? Well, let's turn to the book of Job. Job 7, and we're going to read verse 17 and 18. Job 7, verse 17 and 18. This is from the English Standard Version. I like some of these more modern versions. It just makes thoughts a lot clearer. And this is one very familiar with it. You should probably have a lot of it committed to memory. It says, what is man that you make so much of him and that you set your heart on him, visit him every morning and test him every moment? That's an interesting passage. Have you ever thought of that? God tests us from the moment that we wake up. He's training us. Now, if you were to study this entire passage, you'll see that Job, at this point in the discourse, was a bit unhappy with God. Now, my point, though, is that Job, even in his affliction, understands that God thinks highly of man. He understands that God values man and that God pays attention to man. Let's look at Job 15. Job 15, and we're going to look at verse 14 through 16. This is the response of Eliphaz, if I said that right, to Job. And it's really quite interesting to see how he picks up on Job's question that we just read in chapter 7. He says, what is man that he could be pure, or one born of a woman that he could be righteous? If God places no trust in his holy ones, if even the heavens are not pure in his eyes, how much less man who is vile and corrupt, who drinks up evil like water? Now, Eliphaz here does not explicitly deny God's interest in man, but he does assert that God's relationship with man is distant and untrusting. And according to Eliphaz here, mankind has no chance of becoming clean or pure in God's eyes. Now, we know that's not true. He obviously didn't. Now, we can certainly see why God was not particularly happy with comments like that. Eliphaz is saying that no man has value, no worth in God's sight. Now, David has an answer for the cynicism of Eliphaz with a magnificent statement of God's concern for man in Psalms 8. So let's go ahead and turn back to Psalms 8. And we're going to read verse 1 through 8. And this is going to be out of the Amplified Version because it does kind of expand on the meaning of a lot of the words. Psalms 8, beginning in verse 1. Says, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth, who set your glory on or above the heavens. And let's skip down to verse 3. When I view and consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained and established, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the earth-born son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little lower than God, and you have crowned him with glory and honor. You have made him to have dominion over the works of your hands, and you put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, yes, and the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, and the fish of the sea that pass through the paths of the sea. So in David's view, God considers mankind valuable enough to rule his creation. At least he entrusted us with it. I'm not too sure how great a job we've done with it. Mankind has followed the paths of Satan, and they failed to rule adequately. And we'll see in a moment that Paul quotes this same passage in Hebrews and makes a very important point about the value of man. But before we get there, let's stop at Psalm 144. This is one that was attributed to David as well. Psalm 144, we're going to begin in verse 3. He says, "Lord, what is man that you care for him? The son of man that you think of him? Man is like a breath. His days are like a passing shadow." And let's skip down to verse 7, where David expresses understanding that people are valuable enough to God that he will help them. He says to God, "Reach down from heaven, rescue me from deep water, and set me free from the grasp of foreigners who speak, whose mouths speak lies, whose right hands are deceptive. God, I will sing a new song to you. I will play on a 10-string harp for you, and you are the one who gives victory to kings, who frees his servant David from the deadly sword. Set me free and rescue me from the grasp of foreigners." Now, this is interesting. We have to read between the lines just a little bit here. But David understands that man is short-lived. His current life is vanity. Yet, God places enough value in him to respond to people's cries for help. God cares for his people, in this case, delivering the righteous from lying foreigners, his servant David. Now, there's something else here, and I hope you caught it. David seems to actually be looking forward to a time that he will sing a new song to God, not in this life. I'm not sure if he specifically knew about the Sea of Glass, and things like that, but he certainly looked forward to the time when he, too, would have life forever in God's house. He understood that mankind was so valuable to God that he had the potential for eternal life with God. Okay, let's go to the New Testament now, to Hebrews 2, verse 5. This is what I alluded to a little bit a while ago. Hebrews 2, beginning in verse 5, and we'll read through verse 11. Here is where Paul quotes Psalms 8, where we were earlier. And speaking of God, Paul writes here, "For God did not subject the world, which is to come, concerning which we speak, to angels. But someone somewhere testified, saying, 'What is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you visit him? You have made him a little lower than the angels. You crowned him with glory and honor. You have subjected all things under his feet. For in subjecting to him all things, he left nothing not subjected to him. But now we do not yet see all things